Pressure. Written by Jeff Strand. Narrated by Scott Thomas. Prologue. For a while, the bullets were the only things keeping me alive. It was a sack of 114 of them, each with a date scratched onto the casing. The first date was nearly 4 months ago, a Thursday. I'd spent that entire morning in the bathtub, tears streaming down my face, the barrel of a revolver in my mouth, garbage bags taped to the wall so the landlord wouldn't have to repaint. I wasn't sure that I really wanted to commit suicide, but yet I couldn't force myself to pry the gun barrel from between my teeth. Finally, I did pull the gun away and removed the bullet. Then I scratched 1225 onto the casing with a pocket knife as a reminder that I hadn't killed myself that day. I was in the bathtub even longer on Friday, but I still didn't shoot myself. This time I wanted to. Desperately. I was biting down so hard on the barrel that when my front tooth cracked, I thought for a second that the gun had fired. I'm not sure what ultimately kept me from pulling the trigger. Probably cowardice. But in the end, I had a second unused bullet and another date. This became a daily ritual. Sometimes it got really, really bad. There were times, usually late at night, when the only thing keeping me from killing myself was the sight of the bag of bullets, the knowledge that I'd survived each of those days. So why couldn't I survive just one more? Other times I'd casually put the gun to my head for a half a second, then plop down on the couch and watch some TV. As the sack of bullets grew heavier, it became easier not to want to pull the trigger. My life became less about escape and more about the realization that I couldn't hide away forever. I didn't need to. I'd made it through 114 days. On the 115th day, I decided that I probably had better things to spend my money on than bullets I wasn't shooting. That freakishly cold evening, I dropped the revolver in the sack, tied it tight, and walked 6 miles to the Winston Bridge. As I tried to ignore the happy father walking on the other side, his daughter perched up on his shoulders, I prepared to fling the sack into the pond below and begin a new era of my life. Then I thought, no, bad idea. The last thing I needed was for the sack to wash up on shore and some kids to find it. I'd just have to begin this new era of my life without a symbolic act. I looked at the father again, burst into tears, and walked to the nearest bar, where I got so drunk that I knocked myself unconscious when I fell off the bar stool. I woke up outside with blood in my eyes and the change missing from my pockets. I'm sure I would have shot myself right then and there. Except that the bastards had also taken the sack with my gun and bullets. I just lay there on the ground, shivering, unable to see anything beyond my breath, misting in the air, trying to remember if there had ever been happy times. There had been. In fact, there'd been wonderful times. But that's not where the story begins. Part 1. Children. Chapter 1.
That's all you've got to do. Steal the condoms and you're in the club.
I nervously shifted my weight on the propped-up bicycle as we waded across the street, a dirt road that seemed to be comprised of one part dirt, 9 parts jagged rocks, from the small drugstore.
I don't know. Can't I just steal the candy bar or something?
Paul shook his head.
It's gotta be rubbers. But what if I get caught? I could go to jail.
Marty chuckled.
Then you can be an honorary member from your cell.
I sighed. At age 12, I knew the basic function of the product they were asking me to shoplift, but I also knew that we weren't going to be getting any actual use out of it.
How about this? I'll steal 3 candy bars. That's a lot harder, don't you think?
If we wanted candy bars, we could just buy candy bars,
Paul explained, scratching the stick-on cobra tattoo on his right arm and then pushing up his thick glasses.
And it's not going to be hard. He's half blind.
But what are you going to do with them? What do you think?
Marty asked. Use them. You are not.
Sure we are. They make great water balloons.
Come on, guys, I protested. Let me steal something else. Anything else.
Paul nodded.
Okay. Steal a box of maxi pads.
No way.
Rubbers or maxi pads, your choice.
If I'd still lived in Dayton, Ohio, I wouldn't so much as stolen a soggy straw wrapper for the privilege of hanging out with kids like Paul and Marty. They were both gargantuan nerds who somehow convinced themselves that they belonged to the tough guy crowd. The first time I ever saw Marty, he was sucking on his inhaler after an unsuccessful attempt to rough up a 10-year-old for his lunch money. Paul's mom still cut the crusts off his peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and included a daily note expressing her motherly love, though he always made a big show of crumpling it up and throwing it into the garbage. But Trimble, Arizona, population 6,000, was not an easy place for a newcomer. The children all knew each other and had known each other their entire lives. The cliques were firmly in place. There was no room for a skinny, introverted, completely non-athletic kid with an ugly purple birthmark covering his chin. I'd sat by myself at lunch for 3 full weeks, hoping somebody would take pity on me, but the other kids seemed perfectly content to go on pretending that I either didn't exist or carried a communicable disease, perhaps one with an oozing flesh motif. So when Paul and Marty asked me to go on a bike ride one day after school, I enthusiastically agreed.
"Chicken," said Paul. "Chick, chick, chick, chicken."
He tucked his hands under his armpits and began making what he apparently thought were chicken noises.
"You sound like a duck," Marty told him. "I do not." "Then you sound like a retarded chicken." "I do not." "Okay, you sound like a special chicken."
"What does that mean?"
Paul asked.
"A retarded chicken." "Kiss my ass."
My fervent hope was that this conversation would continue until it was time for us to go home for dinner. But unfortunately, "kiss my ass" turned out to be its natural conclusion.
"Do it, Alex," said Paul. "Otherwise you don't get to be in the club."
"I don't even want to be in the club."
"Yeah, right."
"Yeah, right."
"Are you sure he's half blind?"
"He probably won't even look up," Marty insisted. "We steal stuff from him all the time."
My stomach was churning and I could feel a headache coming on, but I nodded, slung my backpack over my shoulder, and silently walked toward the drugstore. This was stupid. This was so stupid. This was truly, deeply, incredibly, astoundingly, jaw-droppingly stupid. But I was going to do it. A bell tinkled as I pushed open the door. Mr. Greystein looked up from his Christian Living magazine and frowned. From the way Paul and Marty had been talking, I'd expected some shriveled geezer in his 90s, but Mr. Greystein didn't look any older than 50. The drugstore was small and poorly lit, not much more than 3 aisles and a cooler. Behind Mr. Greystein was a display of cigarettes.
"Leave it at the counter," he said.
"What?"
"Your backpack. Leave it at the counter."
I walked over and placed my backpack on the counter. Since the backpack was to be the vessel through which my dastardly crime would be committed, this wasn't a good development. Mr. Greystein glared at me for a moment longer, and then returned his attention to his magazine. I walked over and pretended to look over the candy selection. The boxes of condoms were on a rack right next to the front counter. Even if I'd had my backpack, they'd be nearly impossible to swipe. How could I possibly do this? Why was I even willing to try? My stomach had gone from the churning sensation to outright pain, and the headache was throbbing with full force. I read the nutrition information on a Snickers bar while I tried to decide what to do. Just leave. Who cared what Marty and Paul thought? Maybe if I bought them each a candy bar, they'd let me join the club anyway. After all, it... Then I realized something that should have been obvious from the beginning. I didn't need to steal the condoms. I could just buy them. Marty and Paul would never know that they weren't stolen merchandise. I could be a liar instead of a thief. Of course, not having researched prophylactic purchasing restrictions, I wasn't sure if it was legal for a 12-year-old to buy them. This wasn't like alcohol or cigarettes, was it? Quickly, before I lost my nerve, I returned to the register. I grabbed a random box of condoms, set it on the front counter, and then set the Snickers bar next to the box, as if that might distract Mr. Greystein from my other purchase. He regarded me for a long moment.
"How old are you?"
12.
"Do your parents know you're buying these?"
I shook my head.
Don't you think you're a little young?
I shrugged.
I think you're a lot young. I really don't think I should be selling you these. I can't imagine that a boy your age is responsible enough for that kind of thing, can you?
I shrugged again.
He stared at me for a moment longer, and then his mouth curled up into the beginning of a smile. See, I don't think you've fully considered this purchase, he said, tapping the box. These are lambskin condoms, which aren't as trustworthy as the latex variety. The only reason you'd want these is if you or your partner had an allergy to latex. Do you or your partner have an allergy to latex?
I didn't respond.
Don't be shy. If you're not comfortable discussing the product, you're certainly not comfortable using it. Do you or your partner have an allergy to latex?
No, sir.
Well, then, this isn't what you want.
He shoved the box aside, leaned over the counter, and retrieved another box.
Now, this brand is ribbed for her pleasure. Do you know what ribbed means?
No.
My ears were ringing so loudly that I could barely hear him.
It means that it has ridges that help with stimulation. That's definitely something you want. It's only common courtesy. I'm not sure about spermicidal lubricant. You seem like you might be too young for that to even be a problem. Although I guess by the time you work through the entire box, it could be a different story. What do you think?
I don't know.
You can't be an informed consumer with an attitude like that. You wouldn't just grab any old candy bar off the shelf, would you? You'd make sure that if you were in the mood for peanuts, it had peanuts. Or if you wanted nougat, that it had nougat. And so on, right?
I guess so.
Of course so. May I ask your name?
Alex.
Tell me, Alex, do you honestly feel that you're ready to buy these condoms, or should you maybe call the whole idea off? The whole idea, if you know what I mean.
I like to call what happened next the trigger event for everything else that was to happen in my life. That's probably not accurate. The trigger could have been agreeing to steal the condoms in the first place, or meeting Paul and Marty, or my parents moving us to Trimble. Or hell, just my being born, if you wanted to get technical about it. However, I can say with absolute certainty that in 12 years of a life that included no small number of poor judgment calls, this was far and away the worst decision I'd made up to that point. I grabbed the box of condoms and ran. I shoved open the door at full speed and sprinted across the dirt road toward Paul and Marty.
Go! I screamed. Get out of here! Go, quick!
They took off riding without hesitation, knocking over my bicycle in the process. Nearly hyperventilating with panic, I pulled it upright, jumped on, and began frantically pedaling after them. I didn't dare look behind me because I just knew that Mr. Greystein was standing outside of his drugstore, holding a shotgun, not afraid to use it, even on a kid. I cringed and gritted my teeth, waiting for the sound of the shotgun blast and the unwelcome sensation of my head being blown apart. It didn't come. But I still didn't turn around. Maybe the only thing preventing my death was his unwillingness to shoot me in the back. Would he call the police? Would they be able to find me? Of course they would. In a town this small, the police would have no problem finding a shoplifter based on Mr. Greystein's physical description, especially when the idiot shoplifter had left his backpack right there on the counter. I squeezed the handbrakes, leaned over, and threw up onto the dirt.
Just go back there. Return the condoms, apologize, and beg him not to call the police. Tell him you'll pay twice as much as they cost. 3 times if he wants. You don't have that much right now, but next week when you get your allowance...
Marty and Paul, far ahead, turned the corner and vanished from sight. Still no sound of a shotgun. I needed to go back. Instead, I threw up again, and then rode home as fast as I could. I parked my bicycle behind the house in case Mr. Greystein drove around looking for it. Since he had access to my name and address in multiple places in my backpack, it was unlikely that he'd resort to prowling the town looking for my bicycle, but I wasn't exactly thinking at maximum logical capacity. Then I went into my room, sat on my bed, and stared at my pillow for the next hour until I was called to dinner.
"Did you get your homework done?" my father asked, disinterestedly, taking a bite of broccoli.
Most of it.
Why not all of it?
Too hard.
Not to mention that Mr. Greystein was probably rifling through my backpack at this very moment. My father made no comment and took another bite. The phone rang. My stomach lurched. My mother got up, pushed back her hair, and went into the kitchen to answer. I tried to scoop up a forkful of macaroni and cheese, but I couldn't force my hand to work. Even if I could, I didn't see any possibility of swallowing it without puking again. I waited, desperately listening for some sign to indicate who my mother was talking to. The police wouldn't phone beforehand, would they?
"Hi, Mrs. Fletcher, this is the law. We're on our way to apprehend your son, so if you've got any furniture you don't want riddled with bullet holes, we recommend that you move it into the garage as soon as you can."
"Mm-hmm," my mom said from the kitchen. Then she laughed. Thank God it wasn't about me, unless the person on the other end had used some light humor to break the ice before informing my mother that her son was a wanted criminal. My mother talked on the phone for less than a minute and then returned to dinner. I told her that I had a stomachache, the truth, and was excused from the table. The next morning, my stomachache was worse than ever, like I'd spent the night swallowing shards of glass with a chaser of rusty nails. I had to go to school anyway. I talked to Paul and Marty briefly at lunch. That is, they talked to me, laughing about our close call and welcoming me into the club, while I silently kept a close watch on the lunchroom entrance, waiting for Mr. Greystein to show up, flanked by a pair of armed police officers. Because I didn't have any of my homework or textbooks, I received 2 hours of detention, which was a long time to sit after school with nothing to do but worry about whether or not Mr. Greystein had contacted my parents. When I finally got home, he was seated on the living room sofa. I immediately burst into tears.
"Go to your room,"
said my mother, sounding neither angry nor upset. Her voice was barely audible, which was unusual for her.
"Your backpack is at the foot of the stairs. Do your homework."
I grabbed my backpack, ran upstairs, sat in my doorway, and tried to listen in on the conversation below. I could only catch quick pieces.
"A good kid," I heard Mr. Greystein say.
"No excuse," said my father.
"A tough age," said Mr. Greystein.
And finally, perfectly clear from my father,
"We'll take care of it."
The front door opened and then closed. I sat there waiting to be called downstairs for my unimaginable punishment. 5 minutes passed. 10 minutes. 20. This was going to be a scary one if it was taking them this long to decide. Usually my mother could blurt out punishments mere seconds after the offending action, or just as often before the infraction even occurred. Of course, I'd never done anything nearly this bad before, so there was no precedent for this level of discipline. 1 hour. I wasn't called down to dinner. I didn't dare go downstairs. 2 hours. 3. I went to bed. I didn't sleep. The alarm went off at 6:30, and I rolled out of bed, never having undressed. When I looked over, my parents were standing in the doorway. I wanted to cry again, but I forced myself to stay calm. Tears would only make them madder. My mother sat down on the bed next to me while my father remained in the doorway.
"What did you do with them?"
she asked.
"Threw them away."
"Why?"
"Didn't want them." "Then why did you steal them?"
I shrugged.
"Alex, why did you steal them?"
"To get into a club."
"I see. And you think that was a good reason?"
"No."
"Then why did you do it?"
"I don't know."
"Well, I suggest that you figure that out."
I sniffled.
"Am I going to jail?" "Do you think you should?"
I was silent.
"No, of course you're not going to jail. He didn't call the police. He wants you to pay for what you stole, and he thinks you should help out in his store, maybe for a few hours on weekends. He thinks you'll learn responsibility."
I nodded, relieved that I wouldn't be spending time in prison with murderers, rapists, and fellow condom filchers.
"I'll do it." "No, you won't. You're going to a new school."
"We're moving?"
"No."
I thought about that. There was only one school for kids my age in Trimble, which could only mean...
"I'm moving?"
"I'm sorry, Alex.
You're sending me away?"
"It's not a military school, but it's a school for kids who need the extra discipline. Honestly, your father and I don't know what else to do with you."
The tears started flowing now, and I didn't try to stop them.
"But this is the only thing I've done,"
You know that isn't true.
It is true. I've never done anything like this before. I'll never do it again, I promise. Please.
You should have thought about the consequences before you shoplifted. I shook my head violently.
You can't send me away. It's not fair.
It's totally fair, said my mother. And you need help.
No, I don't. Can't I prove it? Let me prove it. I'll be perfect, I promise.
You had your chance.
But that was the first time,
I said with a whimper.
And the last time.
I sat alone on my bed, shoulders quivering, tears and snot flowing down my face. I was a bad kid, a rotten kid, a terrible kid. I was a thief and a liar. I deserved to be sent to this school. In fact, I deserved to go to jail. A terrible, rotten, miserable, evil kid. I looked in the mirror. I stared at myself for a moment, and then began making the most awful faces I could manage. I stuck out my tongue and scrunched up my eyes, contorting my face into ghastly expressions, worthy of a kid like me. A terrible kid. The worst kid in the world. It felt good to know I was that terrible. It was refreshing. A relief. Because otherwise, I was a perfectly decent kid whose parents just didn't want him. 3 weeks later, with nothing but clothes and a suitcase with a checkers board, a magic kit, a small bag of store-bought chocolate chip cookies, and my stuffed walrus Farley, I was in the car on my way to Brantford Academy. Chapter 2
Here at Brantford Academy, you will obey the rules, said Mr. Seven, the headmaster. He was in his 60s, short, mostly bald, and almost absurdly thin, but yet there was nothing even remotely frail about the man. Though my parents and I were the only ones in his office, he spoke as if addressing an entire auditorium full of students. You will wake up every morning at 5:30 sharp. The concept of a snooze alarm does not exist here. Breakfast is at 6:15 in the common dining hall. Classes begin at 7 sharp and continue until lunch at 11:30. You will have 1 hour for lunch and then 3.5 more hours of classes. Mandatory study time is from 4 sharp until 6, followed by dinner. 7 sharp to 8:30 is used for further study time or various group activities, while 8:30 to 10 is free time, providing that such a privilege has been earned. Lights out at 10 sharp.
He looked at us as if to be sure we understood, and then nodded with satisfaction.
Tardiness to any class will adversely affect your grade. All assignments must be turned in at the time they are due, without exception. An A-level paper turned in late will receive an F.
I raised my hand. Mr. Seven blinked with surprise, as if unaccustomed to such astounding rudeness during his speech.
Yes?
What if I'm sick?
Students who are legitimately ill stay in the infirmary, and their classroom attendance requirements are determined on a case-by-case basis. While I can assure your parents that we provide excellent medical care, I can assure you, Mr. Fletcher, that feigning illness to get out of class is simply not possible. Your days of faking stomach pains to avoid taking a test are over.
I've never done that.
For a moment, I genuinely believed that Mr. Seven was going to slap me across the face.
Mr. Fletcher, I realize that your parents are still here, but effective immediately you are to follow the rules of conduct at Brantford Academy, and that means you will not interrupt when an adult is speaking. Is that perfectly clear?
Yes, sir.
He just meant that he doesn't fake being sick to get out of going to school, my mother explained. I was speaking hypothetically, said Mr. Seven. And many new students who are not used to being held to our high standards, or any standards in some instances, do attempt to use the infirmary as an escape from their responsibilities. So let me make this clear. It does not work. Your dormitory will have 4 boys to a room. The rules of conduct will be explained when you arrive there. Infractions will result in a loss of privileges, including but not limited to loss of free time, loss of male privileges, both sending and receiving, and restrictions to the academy grounds on Saturdays. This will apply equally to all 4 boys in the room, so you are not merely responsible for your own behavior, but for the behavior of your roommates. Are there any questions?
We had no questions. Mr. Seven looked directly at me.
It is not standard policy to admit students after the term has begun, but we had a recent dismissal. I sincerely hope that making this exception will not prove to be a distraction.
He said this as if I should be appreciative that he let me in. I wanted to inquire as to exactly which magical universe he was living in, where letting me be a student in this hellhole was doing me a favor, but that didn't seem like a question to which he would respond favorably. After signing several papers, my parents and I were given directions to the dormitory, Dorm B. I was silent during most of the 5-minute walk, trying to force myself not to ask the desperate question that was on my mind. But once we stopped in front of the 4-story white brick building, I asked anyway, trying but failing not to sound like I was begging.
Isn't there something I can do so I don't have to stay here?
There wasn't. Once inside, there was no real tour to speak of. The guy in charge seemed annoyed that we were distracting him from his newspaper. He gave a cursory wave to where I could pick up my mail, so long as that privilege wasn't revoked, and led us up 2 flights of stairs to room 308. He unlocked the door and motioned for us to enter. It wasn't as bad as I'd expected, although at this point my expectation had been barren gray walls, iron bars, and stone mattresses, without pillows or blankets. Or perhaps even a personal torture chamber, complete with a hairy gentleman in a black hood. There was a set of bunk beds on each side of the room, and a pair of desks with 2 chairs each. Though the room was supernaturally tidy, at least based on my personal experience with rooms, a poster of a Dalmatian and another of a pug, along with a Star Wars movie poster, livened it up.
"The 7th graders aren't back yet," said the guy, who had never introduced himself. "They're at a museum, I think. Probably won't be back for an hour or two. I don't know if you want to go out and get some lunch or something like that."
I almost thought my mother was just going to ask if she could leave me with him, but instead she said,
"That sounds fine. Alex, is McDonald's okay?"
I nodded. I didn't say anything during my last meal and wasn't even able to finish half of my Big Mac. My parents talked to each other about what a great opportunity this was for me, and how it would open up many wonderful doors to my future, and how this summer we'd take a really fun family vacation. I pretended to be excited about this idea, just to let them ease their guilt. After lunch, we went to a mall to buy some last-minute supplies, but since I couldn't think of any last-minute supplies I needed, we wandered around aimlessly for an hour and a half until it was time to go back. The same guy was there when we returned. My mother cried a little as we said our goodbyes, and my father patted me on the shoulder, silently telling me to be brave. The guy led me back upstairs to the room and opened the door without knocking.
"Here you go," he said.
I stepped inside, and he shut the door behind me without another word. I stood exactly where I was, unable to move. The 3 boys looked me over, immediately sizing me up. 2 of them were seated on the floor playing a game of cards, while the other read a hardcover book at his desk.
"Hiya,"
said one of the boys on the floor. Even sitting on the floor, he was obviously quite tall and overweight, with a chubby face, a blonde crew cut, and wire-framed glasses.
"Hi," I managed to blurt out.
"What happened to your chin?"
I self-consciously touched the purple blotch on my chin. "I was born with it this way."
"It's cool-looking."
"Thanks," I said, relaxing a bit.
"What's your name?"
"Alex."
"Alex what?"
"Fletcher."
"I'm Peter McMullen."
The other kid on the floor also had a crew cut, though he had black hair and an average build. He set down his cards.
"And I am Jeremy!"
He announced this as if introducing a rock band, and then mimicked loud audience cheers.
"Hi. Want to play?" Peter asked. "It's Crazy Eights."
"Sure." I sat down on the floor next to them. The boy seated at his desk had a dark complexion and thick black hair that hung almost into his eyes. That was a good sign that at least I wouldn't be forced into a military haircut. The boy looked away from his book and sat there as if waiting for somebody to introduce him. When nobody did, he returned to his reading.
"How come they made you go here?" asked Peter,
shuffling the deck. "I stole something."
"Cool. What'd you steal?"
I considered telling the truth, but then thought better of it.
"Some candy." "That's it?"
"Yeah."
"They sent you here just for stealing some candy?"
"And a bunch of other stuff," I said, scared about what the other boys would think of me if they knew that my parents had just been looking for an excuse to send me away. There had to be something wrong with a kid who was that unwanted.
Was it good candy?
Peter asked.
Snickers. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's probably what I'd steal.
He nodded approvingly as he began to deal the cards.
Why are you here? I asked. Because I'm dumb.
He got bad grades at his old school, said Jeremy.
Yeah, because I'm dumb.
I want to know why if grades go A, B, C, D, and F, they don't use E.
Jeremy's voice deepened a bit as he made this observation.
Because F stands for failed, stupid.
So what does D stand for?
Dumb, like me.
Peter crossed his eyes and let his tongue hang out to make himself look quite dumb.
I just think that if we go to school to learn things, they shouldn't mess up the alphabet.
He set down his cards.
Don't start yet. I'm going to write that down.
Jeremy stood up, hurried over to the desk that the other boy wasn't using, and began to write in a spiral-bound notebook.
Why is he doing that? I asked Peter.
He thinks he's funny.
Peter picked up Jeremy's cards and looked at them.
Is it really bad here?
I asked.
Sometimes. Not all the time. It can be fun, too, but you have to make sure you get your homework done and keep the room clean and aren't late. For a lot of stuff, they punish the whole room. But I'll make sure you know what you're supposed to do.
Thanks.
Don't look at my cards, said Jeremy, closing his notebook.
I wasn't. They're in your hand.
I was just keeping them safe from Darren.
The boy at the desk looked up from his book again.
Ha ha. Hee hee, said Peter.
Ho ho,
added Jeremy. They all looked at me expectantly.
Har har, I said.
Jeremy sat down and grabbed his cards from Peter.
So are we playing or what? Who dealt this garbage? Did you ever notice how everybody on a card has an upside-down head instead of a butt? They're all a bunch of buttheads.
You've already said that, Peter told him.
But not to him.
Wouldn't that make them head-butts? I asked. Jeremy considered that and then set down his cards.
Hold on a second, he said, returning to his desk.
How come you're here? I asked him as he opened the notebook again.
To babysit Peter.
No, really.
Because my parents sent my older brothers here and it straightened them up real good, so I got sent here too. But I make extra money babysitting Peter.
I glanced over at Darren to ask him the same question, but he'd already returned to his book. We played cards for about an hour. I was sad, scared, and missed my parents, but I knew that I'd get along fine with Peter and Jeremy. At 5:50, the entire residence hall gathered outside, formed a long line, and walked single file to the dining hall, which was the next building over. After we took our seats, I tried to do a quick count and estimated that there were about 400 kids in the room, all between the ages of 12 and 16. About 10 students pushed carts between the tables, handing a cellophane-wrapped dish and a container of milk to each student.
That'll be our job every Thursday at dinner, Peter explained.
Dinner was meatloaf, mashed potatoes, creamed carrots, and a roll. All four were indescribably awful. The meatloaf tasted a lot like the mashed potatoes, which tasted a lot like the creamed carrots. The roll didn't taste like anything. I successfully fought back tears as I thought of my mother's meatloaf, which, to be perfectly honest, was never all that great. After the meal, Peter and Jeremy took me on a quick tour of the school grounds. There were two residence halls, a library, one classroom building, a small administrative building, and a sports field. Even with my horrible sense of direction, I was pretty sure I could keep from getting lost. When we got back to the room, we talked and played some more cards. Peter told me all about Killer Fang, his cocker spaniel, who at this very moment was guarding his room back at home, defending his valuable possessions against evil intruders. He explained how more than anything in the world, he wished that Branford Academy would institute a policy where he could trade Jeremy in for a dog. Jeremy made several pointed observations about how people who loved dogs often grew to resemble them, using the pug poster as a visual aid. Darren kept reading his book. At 10:00, lights out, we went to bed. I was unbearably tired, especially since I hadn't slept the night before, but no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't fall asleep. The next night I did sleep, if only because of my complete mental exhaustion. I slept fitfully for the first week, and twice I woke up crying. Fortunately, this didn't awaken my roommates, unless they were pretending to be asleep in an effort to spare me the humiliation. But by the third week, I was sleeping more or less soundly each night, and I was getting used to the Branford Academy routine. The teachers were amazingly strict, but the classroom material was less difficult than what I was used to, so it didn't take me long to catch up. I made sure to turn in my homework on time and study thoroughly for every test, and there were no problems. The dorm rules were straightforward. Rooms spotless at all times, with surprise inspections at least once a week. No noise after 10 o'clock, although they were generous enough to allow middle-of-the-night bathroom visits. I never could get used to the food. Each and every meal was so bad that the chef had to be doing it on purpose. Culinary incompetence could explain the first 6 or 7 meals, but more than that had to be culinary malice. Peter and Jeremy readily accepted me into their group, and the three of us hung out like best friends. Despite living in the same room as him, I didn't talk to Darren much. If he wasn't studying, he was reading, furiously scribbling in his notebook, or staring into space. I can't honestly say that I'd rather have been at Branford Academy than back at home, but all things considered, the first 3 weeks weren't such a bad experience. 23 days after my parents dropped me off, the room's inhabitants were punished on my behalf. Chapter 3. I hadn't even forgotten my entire history report, just the last page, which had somehow slipped out of the paperclip. Racing back to the residence hall meant I'd be late for class, but that was better than turning in incomplete work. Since I'd never been late before, I probably would only have received a very stern reprimand. Running on the sidewalks was against the rules, of course, but it wasn't a major infraction. Again, with my flawless behavior record up to this point, it probably wouldn't have earned me more than a warning. The collision, however, was a definite source of concern. I ran smack into Mr. Wolfe, my math teacher. The papers he'd been carrying flew everywhere, some of them getting caught in the breeze. Through what I like to think was divine intervention, it was me who was knocked to the ground and not him. He didn't say a word and simply began picking up the papers. After standing indecisively for a long, frightening moment, I started to help pick up the papers that had blown onto the grass. A couple of minutes later, I handed him the stack.
"Be more careful next time," he said, and then continued on his way.
I walked back to the residence hall to get the last page of my report, very carefully. As we returned from dinner that evening, my stomach plunged at the sight of red on our door. It was a bright red door hanger, like the Do Not Disturb signs used in hotels. Officially, it was known as a summons, but the student body called it the Mark of Blood. You could see the bright red color all the way down from the end of the hallway, and that was the point. If your door was bloody, everybody on your floor knew it. I'd only seen one bloody door since arriving at Branford Academy, and it was serious business. It had been on the second floor, and we'd all gone down to look at it, gawking like tourists.
"Oh, shit,"
said Jeremy as we headed down the hall.
"What'd we do?"
asked Peter. I hadn't told any of my roommates about what happened that afternoon. I tried to convince myself that this was a coincidence and that one of the others had screwed up today. Maybe Peter had spilled scalding hot coffee on a teacher, or Jeremy had projectile vomited on Mr. Seven's car. Something like that. Jeremy ran up ahead and pulled the hanger off the doorknob. We hurried over to him, and he held up the summons so that we could see all four of our names written in clear block letters. Summons time? Immediately. At least we wouldn't have to suffer long. Jeremy had told me about some roommates who, several years ago, had received a bloody door on Monday that didn't summon them until Friday. On Thursday, they strung up 4 separate nooses from their ceiling and simultaneously hanged themselves. 3 died. 1 ended up with a broken neck and was currently living in an insane asylum, paralyzed and constantly screaming in terror because the cruel nurse put a bright red door hanger in his padded cell. It wasn't a credible story, particularly because I couldn't see any logical reason that a quadriplegic would need a padded cell, and it seemed unlikely that there would be a doorknob on the inside of his cell from which to hang anything. But as my stomach pitched and jerked, I could certainly see how a bloody door might drive somebody to madness. We silently headed back to the stairwell, doomed men on the walk of the damned. We walked to the administrative building. Mr. Seven's office door was opened, and his secretary sent us inside without a wait. We sat down on uncomfortable plastic chairs in front of his desk. "I understand that there was an incident this afternoon," Mr. Seven asked, adjusting his glasses as he glanced at me. I tried to ignore the dirty looks that Peter, Jeremy, and Darren gave me.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Fletcher, you do realize that students are expected to have their assignments with them when they report for class, do you not?
Yes, sir.
This is not a difficult concept to grasp. Despite that, under normal circumstances, your behavior would only merit a warning. However, due to the, unfortunate additional aspect of the situation, I'm afraid I must punish your room collectively.
But it was an accident, I insisted.
An accident that will not be repeated, he said. This weekend's trip to Perkinville is cancelled for the four of you. You will remain here cleaning the school grounds.
Jeremy groaned loudly.
They didn't do anything, I said.
Mr. Fletcher, are you questioning Brantford policy?
I shook my head.
I expect an actual response when I ask a question, not a pantomime.
No, sir.
Good. Perhaps in the future you will be sure that you have all necessary materials before you leave the room, and will conduct yourself in a less turbulent fashion.
Yes, sir.
Good. The four of you are dismissed.
This sucks,
muttered Jeremy, flopping down on his bed.
I'm really sorry, I said for the sixth or seventh time since we'd left the administration building. I didn't mean to get you guys in trouble.
I've been looking forward to Perkinville all month, said Jeremy.
Why couldn't you remember your stupid assignment?
I told you the page slipped out.
It's because you're so turbulent, said Peter, grinning. I hate turbulent people. I think we all need to be a little less turbulent.
Jeremy, wipe that turbulent look off your face.
It's not funny.
It's kind of funny.
No, it's not. We were going to see a movie.
Yeah, but it was probably a turbulent movie.
You don't even know what turbulent means, Jeremy said, and then he rolled over on his side and glared at me. Just stay away from me for a while.
How's he supposed to do that? Asked Peter. You live in the same room, dork.
Shut up!
You shut up!
Leave him alone, Peter, I said. He's allowed to be mad. I'd sure be mad.
But he doesn't need to be a whiny jerk about it.
I'm not being a jerk, said Jeremy. It's just not fair.
This whole school isn't fair. That's why we're here. Duh.
Why don't you guys fight a little louder? Asked Darren. Let's get ourselves in more trouble. Let's stay on school grounds for the rest of our lives. That'd be fun.
Everybody was silent.
We don't need to go to Perkinville, said Peter finally. Perkinville sucks. We'll have fun here, I promise.
Mr. Wolf himself administered our punishment. I would have expected him to have something better to do on a Saturday than chaperone our manual labor, but maybe it was something he enjoyed doing. Brantford Academy grounds were kept clean as a rule, so it didn't appear at first glance, or even second or third glance, that there was much for us to do. Our job was to scour the campus lawn for every speck of litter, presumably at the molecular level.
I don't want to see even the slightest trace of garbage on this grass, Mr. Wolf explained. I want you on your hands and knees looking for trash. I should be able to walk through here with a magnifying glass and not find anything but grass, dirt, and insects.
He split us into two groups. Peter was put with Jeremy, and I was put with Darren. Darren and I were instructed to go over the entire front lawn of the classroom building and informed that there would be an inspection afterward. Since it would not have surprised me a bit to see Mr. Wolf whip out an industrial-sized magnifying glass and model XL3000 refuse detector, we took this task seriously. The objective, of course, was not to create a tidier Brantford Academy, but for the other students to see my roommates and I crawling around looking for non-existent trash. A little humiliation went a long way. Only the seventh graders had gone to Perkinville, so there were plenty of kids around to watch us work while they enjoyed their free time. Not that any of them would express this enjoyment. From what I understood, laughter, pointing, or a sarcastic comment was a sure way to instantly become part of the group being punished. But I saw the smiles, and the burning sensation in my cheeks and ears wasn't just from the heat.
I found a dime, announced Darren as we entered our second hour.
Yee-haw!
Darren sat down.
Let's take a break. We'd better not. He won't be back for a while.
Mr. Wolf had just left, presumably to check up on Peter and Jeremy, so Darren was probably right. I crawled over and sat down next to him.
This is the stupidest thing I've ever had to do, I remarked.
Darren nodded.
Yeah. They should at least have us paint a garage or something.
He ignored my comment and just sat there and stared at a pair of bluebirds perched in a lower branch of one of the trees. I looked back to make sure Mr. Wolf hadn't suddenly materialized behind us, and then watched the birds with him. They weren't doing anything particularly interesting.
"What do you think they'd do if I shot one of those birds?" he asked.
"You don't have a gun."
"If I did have a gun, what do you think they'd do?"
I shrugged.
"I don't know. They're just birds. Who cares about birds?"
"I'm sure some people do."
"Not me."
"But some people do. Bird watchers and stuff."
"I'd do it," he said in a soft voice. "I'd kill a bird. I'd kill a fucking bird."
He looked at me to gauge my reaction. "People kill birds all the time," I said. "Chicken, turkey."
"Yeah, but I wouldn't shoot them for food. I used to shoot at birds with my BB gun. They're hard to hit. Did you know that?"
I shook my head.
"They are. Of course, it wasn't a very good gun. I had to sneak it out of the house. I never did hit one. Or maybe I did, and it didn't do anything to them. Have you ever been shot by a BB?
"No."
"Me either. I was going to shoot myself in the hand to see how it felt, but I didn't know what it would do.
I knew a kid who got his eye shot with a BB.
"Really? Did you see it happen?"
"No, but he wore an eye patch for a few weeks."
"I would have liked to see that. I wonder what it looked like under the patch."
"He never showed anybody."
"That's too bad."
I looked over my shoulder again. Still no sign of Mr. Wolf. "We should get back to work."
"Okay."
Darren began to crawl through the grass again, sifting through the individual blades with his right hand.
"Yeah, I'd kill a bird."
"What's Darren always writing about?" I asked. We'd been released from cleanup duty, approximately half an hour before the seventh graders were due to return. Crawling around in the grass hadn't seemed like it would be strenuous work, but after several hours of it, we were all totally exhausted. Darren had gone back to dorm B, while Peter, Jeremy, and I sat underneath a tree, relaxing.
"I don't know," said Peter.
"What do you think he's always writing about?"
"I don't know."
I told them about Darren's bird comments.
"I've always thought he was kind of creepy," Peter admitted. "I don't like sleeping in the bunk over him. I keep thinking he's going to shove a knife through the mattress or something."
"Maybe we should find out what he writes about," I suggested. Jeremy began to write with an imaginary pencil.
"Dear Diary, I think tonight I'm going to stick a knife through Peter's mattress and kill him. Love, Darren."
"Ha ha.
Hee hee."
"I'm serious," I said. "We should look at his journal."
"It's probably love letters to Miss Mosher," said Jeremy.
Miss Mosher, who worked in the library, was a perfectly decent, if strict, woman, but our objective 12-year-old opinion was that she was the single ugliest human being on the face of the earth. She looked like a not-so-green version of Yoda. Jeremy's comment ended any trace of a serious conversation, and we broke up into hysterical laughter. 10 minutes before lights out, Darren left the room to go brush his teeth. His journal rested on his shelf.
A quick peek couldn't hurt anything, could it?
Sure, there was the flagrant invasion of privacy matter, and the chance that he might have forgotten his toothpaste or dental floss and catch me in the act, and the fact that his journal could be somehow rigged to let him know when unauthorized personnel had gained access, or it could even be booby-trapped. But aside from that, it was the wrong thing to do. I decided to do the right thing. I went to bed. After the cleanup experience, my relationship with Darren changed. He became a bit more comfortable around me, and I became a bit less comfortable around him. It wasn't just the bird thing. After all, I shared the natural morbid curiosity of any young boy. I'd sun-roasted a few ants in my time, I'd examined the neighbor's cat with fascination after it got run over by a motorcycle, and once I even begged my parents to drive more slowly by a grisly traffic accident, though I was secretly relieved when they refused. But there was something in his tone, something disturbing that I couldn't quite identify. I got the sense that, given a chance, Darren wouldn't just shoot a bird. He'd break its legs and twist its head off. Maybe he'd even press the tip of his tongue against its neck to get a quick taste. The remaining weeks of the semester passed, and I made no effort to get a hold of his journal. We spoke more often, usually about schoolwork or TV shows, but we never really crossed the line from roommates to friends. He just made me feel kind of creeped out. One day, I swore I saw him brush a feather off his shirt as he walked into the residence hall, but I searched the entrance for several minutes and couldn't find it.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, sweetie. I can't talk long. We're on our way out. But how are you doing? Are you studying hard?
Pretty hard.
Do you still like it there?
I'd never actually told her that I did like it here.
It's okay.
That's good. Are you getting along with your roommates?
Yeah.
Have you decided what you want for Christmas?
There are some books I want.
Well, write them in a letter and I'll make sure we get them for you.
I will.
I love you, Alex.
I love you too.
Is there anything else?
No, I was just calling.
So, Alex, what if we weren't able to pick you up for Christmas?
I didn't respond.
Alex,
what?
We might not be able to pick you up for Christmas. Would you be really disappointed?
I don't know.
You can tell me if you would be.
I blinked. A tear trickled down my cheek.
Why can't you?
We're going on a trip, but we won't be back before you start school again.
I could start late.
That's not a good idea. Don't you have friends who are staying there for the holidays?
I don't know.
They said there are arrangements for students whose parents can't come get them. But we don't have to go on the trip if you don't want us to.
I want to come home.
We were going to get you a really big present this year. Maybe we'll even come see you before we leave. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We'll talk about it later. I love you, Alex.
I love you, too.
Chapter 4
Randolph the Red Gun Cowboy had a very shiny gun, and if you ever saw it, you would drop your pants and run.
Jeremy was singing Christmas carols while he and Peter packed for their 2 weeks at home. It was painful to watch them, and I had to keep dabbing at my eyes with my index finger when nobody was looking. Darren, who also had to stay at Brantford over Christmas break, didn't seem to mind.
"Why aren't your parents coming to get you?" I asked him.
Darren shrugged.
"Why should they?"
Then one foggy Christmas Eve, the sheriff came to say, "Randolph, with your gun so bright, won't you shoot my wife tonight?"
"What are you guys gonna do this whole time?"
asked Peter.
"Probably nothing."
While 2 weeks of homework and tests would not have surprised me, it was actually going to be supervised free time with some group activities. Nearly 40 kids were staying. I wondered how many of their parents just didn't want them around. Peter's parents arrived first. His dad looked exactly like him, right down to the crew cut, except that he was taller and chubbier.
"Tell Killer Fang grr for me," I said as they walked out the door.
"Actually, Killer Fang's in the car," said his dad, eliciting a whoop of joy from Peter.
I went down with them, got my face thoroughly licked by the Cocker Spaniel, and wished them all a Merry Christmas. Jeremy's parents came to get him an hour later, leaving me alone with Darren. The first day, we spent most of our time hanging out in the library. Two kids we sort of knew from the first floor, Steve and Terrence, sat at a table with us and played Go Fish, or more accurately, Steve's variation of the game, where certain cards functioned as automatic weapons or grenades that blew cards out of the other player's hands. The sound effects got us shushed a few times, and from a game design standpoint, this rule variation could have used some more playtesting, but it certainly provided us with plenty of entertainment value. Though Lights Out was moved back to 11 p.m. in celebration of the holiday spirit, I went to bed at 10:30 and was asleep within 5 minutes. I woke to the sound of Darren's footsteps. At first I thought he was coming into the room, but the glowing green digits of Jeremy's alarm clock read 12:17. My second thought was that he was simply on his way to the bathroom, but as he opened the door and a dim light from the hallway illuminated him, I saw that he was fully dressed and wearing his jacket. He left the room very slowly, closing the door behind him. I lay there for a while, wondering when he'd return, but fell asleep before he did. When I woke up at 6:30 the next morning, Darren was in his bed. The next night, just before midnight, he did the same thing. This time I woke up when he returned around 3, but pretended to still be asleep. His breathing was heavy as he got undressed and climbed into bed.
Where could he possibly be going that was worth the risk of getting caught?
The next night, December 23rd, he got up again. I watched him slip on his jacket, pick up his journal, and slowly walk toward the door. I quickly closed my eyes as he glanced over his shoulder at me. Silence.
Alex.
I kept quiet.
Alex, you awake?
I could hear his footsteps as he walked toward my bed. I felt his presence as he crouched down beside me.
Alex, he whispered. Go away,
I silently pleaded. Maybe he had a knife.
No, that was stupid. He wasn't going to slit my throat.
I could feel beads of sweat beginning to form on my forehead as I tried to sustain the deep, even breathing of somebody who was fast asleep and not desperately praying for his roommate to leave him alone. Maybe the blade was slowly moving toward my... I opened my eyes.
I knew you were awake, Darren said.
No, I wasn't, I said, trying to make my voice sound groggy, like I was still half asleep.
You just woke me up. What do you want?
I want to show you something.
What?
You've got to come see.
What is it?
I can't tell you. It's outside.
We'll get in trouble.
He shook his head.
Nobody will know. They don't care if we go or not, at least not until school starts again. Get dressed.
I pulled the blanket up over my mouth and nose. I'm not going anywhere, I said in a muffled voice. Darren grabbed a handful of the blanket and tugged it away. I told him, knock it off, as he yanked away the rest of the blanket and threw it on the floor.
You'll love this, Darren promised. It's the coolest thing ever.
You just wanted to see my underwear.
Yeah, those yellow stains make me want to sing a happy, happy song.
It was clear that Darren wasn't going to take a whiny no for an answer, so I got out of bed and slipped into my jeans and a blue t-shirt.
This better be good, I said, putting on my jacket. It is. I swear to God.
We opened the door, made sure nobody was in the hallway, and quietly snuck over to the stairwell. We silently but swiftly moved down the stairs into the lobby and out the main entrance. The school grounds were well lit by street lamps, but there was nobody outside.
See? We didn't get caught, Darren said.
They can still catch us, easy.
Nah, nobody'll be out here this late. It's pretty far, though, so we've gotta hurry.
We broke into a run. It took us less than 5 minutes to reach the main gate. We easily slipped through the bars and began jogging down the sidewalk along Branford Street.
How far?
I asked.
It takes me about 45 minutes.
I can't run for 45 minutes.
Once we turn off this street, we'll just walk.
What if they check our room?
Why would they check our room? Don't be such a baby. Even if we do get caught, this'll be worth it, I promise.
4 blocks later, at a railroad crossing, we walked off Branford Street and followed the train tracks. The tracks were poorly lit, and I stepped carefully to avoid the countless broken beer bottles. It didn't seem like a very safe place for a pair of 12-year-olds to be walking in the middle of the night. Of course, Darren had made it back alive walking on his own, so it couldn't be too dangerous. How many times have you been down here? I asked, stumbling a bit as I nearly stepped on a nail protruding from a piece of wood.
8 or 9, counting tonight. I'd come back every night if I could, but they'll start guarding our building again once school starts back up. Maybe I'll find another way out. Who knows?
A group of kids, probably college age, were standing behind a brick building. A couple of them glared at us, but returned to their conversation and their cigarettes without saying anything.
Did you ever hear that if you put a penny on the track, you can make a train derail?
Darren asked, picking up his pace.
I think so. It doesn't work. You just get a flat penny.
We walked for another 30 or 40 minutes, then left the tracks and came up a small incline about 30 feet behind a small building with a dumpster in the back. A red light bulb illuminated the whole area over the dented rear entrance. Darren knelt down and began carefully brushing the dirt on the incline.
We're here. It stinks. That's just the dumpster. You brought me out here to see a dumpster? Shh, not so loud.
I knelt down next to him.
They have dumpsters back at school we could look at. Make sure there's no glass on the ground,
Darren instructed, lifting a scary-looking shard between his fingers and tossing it aside. He obviously wasn't ready to reveal the purpose of our little field trip, so I brushed at the ground next to him, getting several splinters in my palm. After we were both satisfied that our area was free of glass and hypodermic needles, we lay down on our stomachs.
From this position, we were just able to peek over the incline at the building.
"Isn't this great?" asked Darren. "We can see them, but they can't see us."
"So what are we doing?"
"Have you ever been to a strip club?"
"This is a strip club?"
Darren nodded.
"No way!"
"Yes way.
We're not going to sneak in there, are we?"
"Nah, there's no way we could do it without getting caught. But we don't need to sneak in. They come out that door every once in a while to empty the garbage or smoke a cigarette."
"The women?" I asked.
"Nah, not the women. Some sweaty guy who coughs a lot. But sometimes you can see them walking around back there when he opens the door."
"Really?"
"Yep."
"What'd you see?"
"Twice I saw this lady's tits. And the second time she was standing next to this lady who was wearing this thing that almost let you see her whole butt."
"No way."
"I saw tits, I swear to God."
I looked over at the door.
"How often does he come out?"
"I guess whenever he needs to smoke or they fill up the garbage bag. Not very often."
I frowned.
"What kind of garbage do they make at a strip club?"
"I don't know. It's probably really gross. Probably used underwear and stuff."
"How long can we stay here?"
I asked, glancing at my wrist before realizing that I'd left my watch at the room. Darren checked his own watch.
"At least 2 hours."
"Cool."
We lay there in silence for several minutes.
"How'd you find out about this place?" I asked.
"I forget. I came here a few times during the summer."
I shuddered. Considering how unpleasant the dumpster aroma was in late December, I couldn't imagine what foul odors lurked in this area during the summer. But hey, if there were boobs to be seen. I adjusted my position a bit to make myself more comfortable. It might be a long wait, but with the possibility of such a glorious reward, I could be patient. We talked off and on during the next half hour, mostly speculating about what sights we'd be seeing if we were blessed with X-ray vision. Darren knew countless synonyms for each major component of the female anatomy and wasn't afraid to use them, though I suspected that he made up a lot of them himself. While my own vocabulary wasn't as impressive, I made up for it with sheer imagination. All we needed was X-ray vision, invisibility, and/or the ability to walk through walls, and it would have been the perfect evening. Then Darren nudged me, roughly, and we both stared, transfixed, as the door handle turned with a loud squeak. The door opened. The single most grotesque human being I had ever seen in real life stepped through the doorway. His hairy beer belly protruded from underneath his white t-shirt, as if seeking fresh air. He was mostly bald and had an uneven mustache and goatee, and looked to be covered with at least a quart of sweat. Though I knew I couldn't really smell him from my hiding spot, at least not over the dumpster odor, the stench in the area did seem to increase by at least 25%. He coughed, twisted his neck around to wipe his nose on his shoulder, and headed for the dumpster with his small sack of garbage. This guy got to spend all night looking at naked women. Life wasn't fair. I realized with horror that I'd been watching the ugly, sweaty, smelly guy and not the open doorway. I quickly gave it my full attention. Red lighting inside, just like outside. No boobs visible. The guy flung the garbage bag into the dumpster. For a split second, I wondered if he could see us, but I forced that thought out of my mind and focused on the doorway. Still nothing. The guy coughed again.
"Shit," he muttered.
I thought I could see him scratching his ass in my peripheral vision, but it wasn't a sight worth looking away from the doorway. He headed back toward the building. Only seconds remained before the doorway was shut, perhaps for the remainder of the evening. I furrowed my brow, trying to send brainwaves toward the door to entice one of the women to walk into view. There had to be at least one of them in there who wanted to see the ugly, sweaty, smelly guy scratch his ass. He stopped in the doorway, coughed again, repeated the word shit, and then entered the building, shutting the door behind him.
"Oh, man," moaned Darren. "What a ripoff."
"So what do we do?"
"We wait for the next time."
"How long is that?"
"I don't know."
Darren checked his watch.
"We may have to head back before then."
"Damn.
Damn, damn, damn. Crap, damn, crap."
What if we waited for another 2 hours and our only visual treat was watching the guy scratch an alternate cheek?
But what if the door got stuck the next time and they couldn't close it again? Or what if one of the women came outside?
What if that happened mere seconds after we left?
There's something else we could do, said Darren.
What?
Knock. We'd get in trouble. Not if you ran fast enough. Just knock and hurry back here. They won't catch us.
Why don't you do it?
I've already seen inside.
Right, so it won't matter if you don't get to see it while you're running.
You're the one who wants to see in there, said Darren. Don't worry, I'll make sure you don't get caught.
How?
I just will. I promise. Come on, go up there and knock.
Since Darren had dragged me along to this place without telling me where we were going, there was a definite flawed logic to the whole "you're the one who wants to see in there" line of thinking. I also had very serious doubts about his ability to make sure I didn't get caught, considering that he would be hiding 30 feet away. I tried to express both of these arguments, but somewhere the line of communication between my mouth and brain was disrupted, and my response was far less articulate than I would have liked.
Uh-uh. Fine, said Darren, pushing himself up to a kneeling position. We'd probably better get going anyway.
You're right, I agreed, unwilling to back down.
Darren looked over at the building and shook his head sadly.
Biggest tits I ever saw, he said,
and then started to walk toward the railroad tracks. He was bluffing. He was definitely bluffing. There was absolutely no question in my mind that he was bluffing, at least for his first two steps. Then I decided that he wasn't bluffing at all, and that if I didn't act quickly, I'd rob myself of this golden opportunity.
Okay, okay, I said.
Darren looked back over his shoulder at me and smiled. Not the excited smile of a 12-year-old who might get to see a naked stripper, but the smug smile of somebody who'd convinced his friend to do something against his will. It was, truth be told, a little bit unnerving. But then the smile vanished and his expression turned serious.
All right, I'll watch your back, he said, returning to his spot on the ground. Just knock a few times, loud, and then run back here.
I nodded, took a deep breath, and walked toward the building. Technically, this wasn't as bad as stealing condoms. There was nothing illegal about knocking on the back door of a strip club and running away, at least as far as I knew. Of course, if I got caught and they called Branford Academy, I'd be screwed in a very big way. I walked up to the door. I raised my hand. I looked back at Darren, who nodded his approval. I took another deep breath. I knocked, once, twice. The door opened. Suddenly, I found myself staring directly at a sweat-stained white T-shirt. The ugly guy, one hand out of sight behind him, looked down at me and coughed. My first and second instincts were to run and to pass out, respectively. I did neither, and instead just stood there in shock.
"Yeah?" the guy asked.
I managed to blurt out, or at least something that sounded like that particular vowel.
"This ain't no place for kids," the guy said. "What do you want?"
"I just need to use the phone," I heard myself say, which was a pretty good cover considering that my brain had stopped functioning. The guy shook his head.
"Can't help you. Go someplace else."
"Yes, sir." There was movement behind the guy, and I peeked past him. A woman stood there, with long black hair. She was incredibly beautiful, was covered with a thick sheen of perspiration, and was absolutely, completely, gloriously naked. I'd seen plenty of naked women in movies and a couple of times in magazines, but this was my first time seeing one in real life. There were no surprises, anatomically, but the experience was entirely different. I'm pretty sure I gasped. The woman made eye contact with me, placed her hands on her hips, and winked. The guy glanced back at her briefly, then smiled, revealing dark yellow teeth.
"Get the fuck out of here, kid," he told me as he shut the door.
I stood there for a long moment.
"Alex," said Darren in a stage whisper, "get over here."
I didn't want to go back to Darren. I wanted to cherish the memory of what I'd just seen, but I also didn't want the ugly guy to open the door again and call the cops. I ran back past the dumpster, and Darren and I both ran for the train tracks.
"I can't believe you just stood there," Darren exclaimed.
"Did you see her?" I asked.
"Who?"
"The lady."
"No, I just saw you and the butt scratcher." "What lady?"
"The naked one."
"She was naked?"
"Oh, yeah."
"How naked?"
"All the way."
"Oh, man," said Darren. "I should have knocked."
I grinned and nodded my head.
Yep, you should've. Sucks to be you.
Chapter 5 The day before classes resumed, and 3 days before we found the body of Killer Fang, Peter entered the room in tears. He'd just returned from Christmas break. Jeremy had arrived several hours ago and was busy constructing a snap-together model World War II ship that his grandmother had given him, which he planned to stomp into thousands of pieces once it was complete. "What's wrong?" Jeremy asked.
"He's gone," said Peter in between heaving sobs.
"Who?"
He wiped his nose on his sleeve.
"My dog."
"Killer Fang's gone?" I asked. "What happened?"
It took a while, but Peter managed to explain the situation. He'd taken Killer Fang for a quick walk before his parents had to leave, and the Cocker Spaniel had pulled its leash out of his hands, chasing after a squirrel. It ran off. They chased after it, and the dog never returned. They'd looked for it for over 2 hours, but with absolutely no luck. After he calmed down, we all went out and helped him look. No sign of Killer Fang. His parents had spoken with a local animal shelter and would be contacted if the dog turned up. When we finally quit searching and returned to our room, Peter took out a magic marker and began making lost dog signs, working long past lights out. Though I half expected him to spend the day in the infirmary, Peter got up the next morning and attended all of his classes. A sympathetic teacher agreed to post signs around town, while the fact that a Branford Academy teacher could be sympathetic came as an amazing shock to the rest of us. He ate nothing at lunch, but finished half of his dinner. During the meal, I told Jeremy all about the visit that Darren and I paid to the strip club.
"You saw everything?"
he asked in amazement.
"Yep." "Upper and lower?"
"Yep."
"And I just got a crappy model ship for my grandma."
Jeremy took a sip of milk and sulked for a moment, and then relentlessly quizzed me about the field trip for the rest of dinner. That night, I awoke to the sound of Darren getting out of bed. He left the room, fully clothed. I lay awake for about 15 minutes, waiting for him to return before I fell asleep. During breakfast the next morning, I quietly asked him where he'd gone.
"Last night, where'd you go?"
He scratched his lower lip.
"To the club."
"How'd you get out?"
"Walked."
"Wasn't there a guard?"
"Maybe."
This didn't make sense. If he'd dragged me out of there last time, why would he be evasive about sneaking out again? Maybe he'd gone to see somebody else's room. Just because I wasn't aware of him having any other friends didn't mean that was really the case. Why would he hide that? I didn't push it, but later on I did mention it to Jeremy.
"If he does it again, we need to follow him," he insisted.
"We'll get in trouble."
"Only if we get caught."
"We'll probably get caught."
"Darren didn't get caught."
"We don't even know where he went."
"Right. It could be really great. It might even be better than the strip club. We've got to follow him."
"I don't know."
"Yes, you do."
"No,
yes, you do."
Either Darren was quieter, or he didn't leave at all, or I just slept better than usual. But the next night I fell asleep at 10:15 and didn't wake up until morning. The night after that, I awoke to a rather obnoxious finger poking me in the nose. I was not surprised to open my eyes and discover that the finger belonged to Jeremy.
"Stop it," I said.
He poked me twice more.
"He just left," he whispered. "Hurry up and get dressed."
I was tired and wanted to protest, but I knew that Jeremy wouldn't relent. I got out of bed and quickly put on my clothes while Peter lay in bed snoring softly. Jeremy opened our door just a crack and peered out into the hallway. A moment later, he opened the door all the way and we left the room. We hurried over to the stairwell and pushed the door open very carefully. I cringed at the loud squeak. Below, we heard the footsteps of somebody running down the last few stairs, followed by a door opening and closing. Jeremy made a move to run down after him, but I tugged on the back of his shirt to stop him.
"He won't go anywhere if he knows we're following him," I said.
"Yeah, you're right," Jeremy agreed.
We cautiously walked down the stairs and paused at the door to the lobby.
"How long should we wait?"
"A minute, maybe.
We might lose him."
"It's up to you."
Jeremy considered that for a second.
Let's just go. If he catches us, we'll make him take us with him anyway. Two against one.
He pushed open the door and we walked into the lobby. It was empty. Nobody at the front desk. We began to silently walk toward the exit, moving casually, as if there were absolutely no reason we shouldn't be on our way outdoors for a pleasant evening stroll. I couldn't be sure, but I thought I heard some giggling coming from the small room behind the front desk. Feminine giggling. If anything, that would certainly explain the ease of Darren's, and hopefully our, escape. We made it outside without getting busted. There was no sign of Darren.
We'll just go the way we went before, I suggested.
He probably was simply on his way back to the strip club and was perhaps a bit embarrassed by how much time he was spending in the presence of that most foul of dumpsters. When we reached Branford Street, we could see Darren walking several blocks up ahead. Following behind him and hoping that he didn't decide to turn around was probably not the finest shadowing technique ever demonstrated, but we were afraid that anything more sophisticated might cause us to lose him. Right before he reached the train tracks, he stepped off the sidewalk and ducked into some bushes.
"Is that where you went before?" asked Jeremy.
"Nope."
"I wonder what he's doing."
"No idea."
"He's probably playing with himself."
I laughed.
"He'd at least save that for outside the club."
"Maybe he couldn't wait. We should probably turn back or we might see something really horrible. I'd hate to have to barf all over the place."
"Maybe he stashed some magazines over there."
"Maybe he stashed a stripper over there."
We continued walking.
"What happens if Peter wakes up and tells somebody that we're gone?" I asked. "He wouldn't tell on us."
"He wouldn't try and get us in trouble, but he might get worried."
Jeremy shook his head.
"Nah, he won't do anything. If he does, we'll just say we were trying to stop Darren. We'd all get in trouble for what Darren did anyway, so we might as well be out here enjoying it too."
We stopped talking as we approached the thick bushes. I motioned for Jeremy to stop. We stood there for a moment, listening to the sounds coming from the bushes. They weren't loud, and I couldn't quite tell what they were. They sounded sort of wet. Jeremy put a finger to his lips, and together we began to walk toward the bushes as quietly as possible. The wet sounds continued, vaguely reminding me of my mother peeling the skin off a raw chicken. Jeremy held up three fingers, counting down. 2, 1.
"Gotcha!"
Jeremy shouted as we simultaneously pushed through the bushes. Darren cried out and threw up his hands. A few drops of liquid hit my face. There was a moment of absolute chaos as Darren frantically scooted away from us, and Jeremy's face registered pure horror at what he saw, and I was suddenly overwhelmed by a smell that was far worse than the dumpster outside the strip club. A pair of garbage bags lay on the ground. On top of them was a furry, headless carcass. A slit ran most of the way up its belly. Its severed tail rested on the ground, its head, mouth wide open in a howl, tongue missing, eye sockets filled with tiny maggots, was propped up between two rocks. I violently threw up and then crawled out from the bushes, coughing and trying not to choke. It took me at least 30 seconds to recover enough to focus my attention on anything but my own nausea. Darren stood there, dripping hands at his sides, panting heavily. Jeremy faced him, fists clenched.
"Is that Killer Fang?"
Jeremy demanded.
"Let me tell you what happened. Is that Killer Fang, yes or no?" "Yes, but I didn't kill him. I swear to God I didn't hurt him. I didn't do anything to him. You cut his head off!"
Darren glanced around to make sure there was nobody coming. His nose was starting to run and he wiped it with a bloody finger.
"I didn't do anything to him while he was alive,"
Darren said in a whisper.
"Yeah, right. He got hit by a car." "I don't believe you." "He did,"
Darren insisted.
"I wasn't looking for him. I was just going to walk around town. He was lying on the side of the road. He was already dead. I wouldn't kill Peter's dog. I wouldn't do something like that." "But you would chop him up,"
Jeremy accused, taking a step toward Darren and looking ready to beat him senseless. As horrified as I was by what had happened to Killer Fang, I also knew that getting into a fistfight over it would greatly increase the chances of our little field trip being discovered.
"Don't hurt him," I told Jeremy. "How about I just cut his head and tail off and hide him in some bushes?"
In other circumstances, the tail comment would have been highly amusing, but here we didn't even notice the logistical flaw.
"When did you find him?" I asked.
"Night before last," Darren said. "That time you saw me go out."
"Why didn't you tell Peter?"
"He would have been too sad. You are such a liar, said Jeremy. You think he'd be too sad to know his dog was hit by a car, but not too sad to know you chopped him up?
I wasn't going to tell him anything. This way he could always think that his dog was still alive. He'd be happier.
Bullshit! You don't know. You don't know what I was thinking. You're not in my head. Good thing, or I'd be in a loony bin, which is where you're going to be when people find out what you did.
Darren looked at the ground.
Do we really have to tell anybody?
He asked in a soft, miserable voice.
Yeah,
Jeremy sneered.
We're going to tell everybody.
Please don't.
Everybody at school. Everybody you know. The whole world is going to find out what you did, especially everybody in the loony bin with you.
Please, I'll do anything you want.
They're going to put you in a straitjacket and you won't be able to move, and they'll stick you with giant needles every day, and they'll shock you, and they'll rip out parts of your brain, and they'll laugh and laugh and laugh at you.
I didn't hurt him. If he was alive, I would have got help and told Peter, I promise.
I think you killed him.
I didn't,
Darren wailed.
I'm going to tell Peter you killed his dog.
I didn't.
And they're going to jab you with so many needles that you'll look at your arm and it'll be nothing but holes, and they'll strap you down and...
Leave him alone, I said.
Why should I?
Because you're not helping anything. We need to get back to school before they know we're gone.
We can't just leave Killer Fang out here like this,
said Jeremy.
I'll bury him, said Darren. You guys go back so you don't get in trouble, and I'll bury him.
You just want to cut him up some more.
Darren shook his head vigorously.
I won't. I'll bury him. You can take my pocket knife.
I'd seen Darren use the blade of his pocket knife to clean his fingernails on a few occasions. It was barely an inch long, and while I wasn't exactly an expert on such matters, it seemed that decapitating a cocker spaniel with such a small blade would be a long, incredibly difficult process. I wondered how many hours he'd spent cutting through the dog's neck, how much effort it had taken to get through the spinal column.
Okay,
I told Darren.
Bury him.
We have to show Peter what happened,
said Jeremy.
No way. We can't let him see Killer Fang like that. He'd die.
He would, said Darren. He'd have a heart attack.
Jeremy held up his fist.
Shut up!
We'll let Darren bury him, and we'll go back to the room, and we'll figure out what to do.
If we let him bury him, then there's no proof.
There's no proof anyway, said Darren. I'll just say I found him like that.
Give me your pocket knife, I said.
Are you going to tell Peter?
I don't know what we're going to do yet. Darren picked up the dark red pocket knife, snapped the blade back into the handle, and gave it to me.
See you whenever,
I said, and then turned and began to walk back the way we came. I hoped that Jeremy would follow me, but after I'd gone about 20 feet, I stopped and looked back. He stared at Darren for a moment longer, kicked the ground angrily, and then ran over to catch up with me.
Sick, Jeremy muttered. He's totally sick.
I know.
He should go to jail. I'll bet you anything he killed the dog.
I shook my head. He couldn't catch and kill a dog like that with a pocket knife.
Why not? Sure he could. Maybe Killer Fang was hurt. Maybe he did get hit by a car, but it only broke his legs, so he couldn't get away when Darren found him. You could kill a dog with a pocket knife. Easy.
Maybe.
What are we going to do?
I don't know, I admitted. What do you think Peter would do if we told him?
Freak out and kill Darren?
He won't kill anybody.
He should.
Come on, we need to be serious. Nobody's going to kill Darren. We need to figure out what we're going to tell Peter.
Everything, said Jeremy.
No. You're right, he'd freak out, and then everybody will find out. You know Darren will tell about the strip club, and then we'll all pay for it big time. Mr. Seven will take away every bit of free time we've got until summer. We might even get kicked out.
Somehow, I didn't think my parents would welcome me back into their home with open arms if I got expelled. My next stop would be military school. Probably in a remote location. Somewhere chilly.
So we're going to let him get away with it?
No, but...
I trailed off, unable to think of an alternate solution. We certainly had to let Peter know that his dog was dead, but while I hated the thought of letting Darren go unpunished, was it worth getting in that much trouble ourselves? I truly believed that Killer Fang had been dead when Darren found him, but maybe next time the dog wouldn't already be dead. Would he stop at dogs?
What if we... I don't know. What if we kept it between us and we just made sure he never did anything like that again?
Kept it between the three of us or the four of us?
I'm not sure.
I'm not going to babysit him the rest of my life. I don't care if I do get in trouble. He's not going to get away with this. Peter loved his dog.
I'm not saying he has to get away with it, just that we don't have to get anybody else in on it.
So what? You want us to give him a spanking or something? He cut our best friend's dog's tongue out, just for fun.
Jeremy was right. We couldn't let Darren get away with this, but there had to be a way we could take care of the problem on our own. Maybe just knowing that he'd been caught would keep Darren from doing this kind of thing again. Or maybe...
I know what we could do, I said.
What?
We could scare him. You, me, and Peter can figure out a way to scare the hell out of him. We'll scare him so bad that he will never, ever do something like this again in his entire life.
Chapter 6 Getting back into the residence hall was ridiculously easy. Parents who paid the tuition with the expectation of a secure environment were getting ripped off, big time. On the way back, Jeremy and I worked out a plan. I would have preferred something a little more subtle and a little less cruel, but the end result was one that we could both live with. We also played rock-paper-scissors to determine who had to tell Peter about Killer Fang. Paper covered rock, and I won, but after we snuck back into the room, I decided that Jeremy's rage about the entire situation meant that he might reveal too much before we were ready, so at the last minute I offered to take on the miserable task. Peter was still snoring. I shook him gently until he opened his eyes.
"What do you want?"
he asked sleepily.
"I have to tell you about Killer Fang."
Peter immediately sat up.
"You found him? How is he?"
"He got..."
My throat closed up, and it took me a few seconds before I could continue.
"He got hit by a car."
Peter's lower lip began to tremble.
"He's okay, though, right? He's a pretty tough dog. I bet he made it through okay."
"He got killed. Darren found him."
"Darren doesn't know for sure, does he? He could be wrong. Killer Fang's a pretty smart dog. I don't think he'd let himself get hit by a car. He wouldn't do that."
"He got killed,"
I repeated.
"Oh."
Peter rolled over on his stomach and buried his face in his pillow. His whole body began to quiver. I wasn't sure how to console him, and after standing there for a long, uncomfortable moment, I went to bed. When we got up the next morning, I was very relieved to see that Darren was there. I'd half expected him not to return to the room, maybe even to run away from Branford Academy altogether. I lingered behind with him as Peter and Jeremy went to take their showers.
"Did you do it?"
"Yeah,"
said Darren, almost pouting. He held up his hands, which were raw and swollen.
"Look what happened, because I didn't have anything to dig with."
"Too bad for you."
While I hoped that none of his teachers asked Darren to explain what had happened to his hands, I certainly wasn't going to feel sorry for him.
"I should have used the dog's jaw," he said,
looking me straight in the eye as if daring me to take offense. The frightened, pleading Darren of last night was gone. I couldn't help but take a small bit of pleasure from knowing that soon it would return.
"You were wrong,"
Peter told me as we returned to the room after lunch to pick up our materials for our next class.
"I was?"
"I talked to Darren. He said he doesn't think it was Killer Fang that got run over. He said it was a little black dog and that the people who hit it took it right to the vet." "I guess I was wrong then. I've read a lot about how dogs can find their way home, no matter how far it is. He's pretty fast. It'll probably take him about a week to get back home, so that'll be around Sunday or Monday."
"Well, that's good to hear."
"Yeah, I hope he doesn't get too hungry."
Jeremy and I didn't speak to anybody else about our plan for the rest of the day, or all day Friday. I was growing more and more uncomfortable with the whole idea, but Jeremy was insistent. Darren needed to be punished, and Peter needed to accept the fate of his dog.
"And it'll be fun," Jeremy said.
I strongly disagreed about that aspect, but each time I considered telling Jeremy that he'd have to do this without me, I remembered the headless carcass on the garbage bag. Even though he knew how much Peter missed his dog, how much he loved it, Darren had mutilated its body. He was a sick, scary kid, but when we were done with him, he'd be on his best behavior for the rest of his time at Branford Academy, and hopefully for the rest of his life. Saturday evening. Jeremy and Peter had already snuck out of the building. Darren was seated at his desk, lost in thought. He held his pen but hadn't written anything for the past 20 minutes. "Put on your jacket," I told him.
"Why?"
"We're going out."
"Screw you, I'm not going anywhere."
"You are so. You have to apologize to Peter. You're going to take us out to where you buried the dog, and you're going to say you're sorry for lying about it being a different dog."
"Yeah, right."
"I'm serious, Darren. It's mean to let him think he's still alive."
"Then go out there and show him yourself."
"Yeah, and while we're there, we'll just show him what you did."
"I don't even know what you're talking about."
I desperately wanted to smash my fist into his lying mouth. But of course I didn't, and not just because I was fairly sure that he could beat the crap out of me if it came down to it.
"Don't lie to me." "I'm not. I have no idea what you're talking about. Leave me alone."
"You have a choice," I said, struggling to make my voice sound as cold and calculating as I possibly could. "You can come with me and help Peter get over this, or we can show him what you did to his dog. We can show him that you ripped his tongue out. Maybe he'll do the same thing to you for lying."
"Ooh, I'm so scared," said Darren.
But his eyes seemed to indicate that the statement wasn't necessarily sarcastic.
"Put on your jacket."
He did.
"Why is he so much in love with dogs anyway?" asked Darren as we walked along the sidewalk. "They aren't like people. They don't do anything."
"They do a lot of stuff."
"Like what?"
"They catch frisbees, they fetch sticks, they let you pet them."
"So? What makes that so great?"
"Have you ever had a dog?"
"No way."
"Have you had any pets?"
"Just a goldfish that we flushed."
"So then you don't know what it's like."
"I don't need to know what it's like. I can see what it's like. Dogs don't do anything but run around and slobber. Only stupid people like them."
"Well, good, you don't ever have to have one then." I'd always wanted a dog, but my parents wouldn't allow it. Too much trouble. We left the sidewalk, and a few minutes later my knees weakened as we entered the moonlit woods. I even felt a little scared, almost as if I were the one with a nasty surprise awaiting me. What if Darren had another pocket knife? What if he'd already killed Peter and Jeremy, and their headless bodies were buried next to Killer Fang? Or their chests were slit open just waiting for Darren to reach inside and...
"Stop it. You're being an idiot."
At least I hoped I was. We ducked through the bushes and stepped into the clearing.
"What the hell?"
A noose hung from a branch of the largest tree, which wasn't all that large since this wasn't exactly an immense forest. At least, it was supposed to be a noose. Jeremy hadn't tied it very well, and it was more of a lopsided circle. A wooden crate was positioned directly under the rope. Movement to the left. I stepped out of the way as Peter came up behind Darren and grabbed his arms, holding them behind his back as Jeremy slapped a strip of duct tape over his mouth. Darren struggled frantically, twisting and kicking, but Peter held firmly while Jeremy unspooled more of the duct tape, covered his mouth with the second layer, and wrapped it all the way around his head 3 more times. Peter wrestled Darren to the ground, and together he and Jeremy taped his hands together behind his back. Darren got in a good kick that nearly knocked Jeremy off balance, but it wasn't long before they'd pulled him back to his feet and dragged him over to the crate. I was supposed to be helping, but all I could do was watch. It took nearly a minute of struggle before Peter and Jeremy finally got him on top of the crate. Jeremy pointed to me.
"Get over here, Alex!"
I hurried over to the tree, climbed up onto the unsteady crate, and placed the noose around Darren's neck.
"Don't move," Jeremy warned him as I jumped off. "If you fall off this, you'll choke to death. Do you understand?"
Darren shouted something incoherent at him through the duct tape. Jeremy raised a fist.
"Do you understand?"
Darren continued shouting for a few more seconds, but then finally went silent and gave a small nod.
"Good."
The three of us stepped away from the makeshift gallows and took a moment to catch our breath. Peter looked terrible. Even in the poor light, I could see that his eyes were red and puffy, and he had the look of somebody who'd spent the past hour being kicked in the head.
"Okay, let's do it so we can get back," I said.
"Darren Rust, you have been accused of the crime of murder," said Jeremy in a booming voice. "You hunted down Peter's dog, Killer Fang, and you stabbed him to death with your pocket knife, and you dragged him into the bushes and chopped up his body. How do you plead?"
Darren said something that we couldn't understand.
"Nod for guilty and shake your head for not guilty," said Jeremy.
Darren shook his head.
We know what you did. We all know. We can look into your very soul and see what you did, Darren Rust, and you must be punished.
I'd written the line about looking into Darren's very soul, and I was amazed how well Jeremy was able to deliver it.
You must be punished for your cruel actions, for your taking of an innocent life. You must suffer just as Killer Fang suffered.
Peter glanced over his shoulder.
Did you hear that?
We all looked back in that direction. We waited for a few moments, hearts racing. Nothing.
The words of the Bible say, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth,
Jeremy told Darren.
To punish you for what you've done, we must chop your head off and shove maggots in your eyes. We must cut open your stomach and make you eat food again. Maybe we'll even surgically implant a tail so we can rip it off.
That last line hadn't been planned and certainly wouldn't have been approved by the creative team.
Peter, as the owner of the victim, do you feel that the punishment of the accused is fair and just?
Peter nodded.
I do.
Alex, as the impartial witness, do you feel that the punishment of the accused is fair and just?
I nodded as well.
I do.
Then, Darren Rust, you have been fairly sentenced by a jury of your peers, and you must accept the punishment we have decided for you.
The three of us simultaneously took a step forward. The crotch of Darren's pants darkened.
The accused has pissed his pants, Jeremy gleefully announced. He's wet himself in court. Oh, my God!
I looked over at Peter. He didn't seem amused.
Did you see that?
Jeremy asked me, laughing.
What a baby!
Knock it off, I told him.
But he pissed his pants,
Jeremy pointed to him.
I can't believe he did that. Shut up, Jeremy. Fine, fine, fine,
he resumed his booming tone.
If the accused would like to speak any final words before his sentence is carried out, well, too bad, because his mouth is taped shut. I guess we should have taped his wee-wee, too. Damn it, Jeremy. Okay, okay. Darren Rust, upon the count of three, the jury of your peers will carry out your punishment. One.
We all took another step forward.
Two.
Darren looked terrified and frantically began struggling to free his taped hands.
Three.
Darren stepped backward to get away from us, and the crate toppled onto its side. I swore I heard a loud crack as he dropped. Before I could fully register what had happened, Darren was dangling from the tree, the noose tight around his neck.
Shit!
Peter screamed. Darren's legs kicked wildly 2 feet above the ground as he struggled to get free. Peter and I rushed forward, and I immediately received a violent kick to the chest that knocked me backward several steps, gasping for breath.
Stop moving!
Peter shouted at Darren, but the accused was too panicked to listen. Jeremy just stood there frozen. I ran back over to the tree, turned the crate right side up, and pushed it underneath Darren's feet while Peter tried to keep him steady. Once Darren was on solid footing again, I hopped up onto the crate, quickly loosened the noose, and removed it from his neck. His skin was red and glistening where the rope had dug into it. Peter and I helped Darren down from the crate. I hurriedly unwrapped the duct tape from around his head, ripping off some hair in the process. Darren sucked in a deep breath, sounding like he was hyperventilating.
Oh, God! Look what we did to his neck,
Peter said, his voice frantic. Jeremy still hadn't moved. Darren fell to his knees, coughing and choking. I tried to free his wrists, but my hands were trembling too badly to unpeel the edge of the tape.
Are you okay?
Peter asked.
Can you breathe?
Darren continued coughing. He might have been sobbing, too, but I couldn't tell.
We didn't mean it,
I insisted.
We were just trying to scare you.
Get away from me,
Darren managed to shout.
Just leave me alone.
We all moved away from him. Darren stayed on his knees for an unbearably long time, just staring at the ground and trying to catch his breath. Finally, he spoke.
My neck hurts.
We're sorry, I said.
I mean, it really hurts. It might be broken.
It can't be broken, Peter said.
Shut up, you don't know. Get this off my hands.
It took a couple of minutes, but I finally managed to get the tape off his hands. He held them in front of him, clenching and unclenching his fists. Then he touched his neck and gazed at his red fingertip.
I'll probably have to go to the hospital.
You might not,
said Peter.
It doesn't look that bad.
Well, it feels that bad. You guys made me bleed out my neck. I might die. I hope I do die. Then we'll see what happens to you.
Jeremy suddenly came out of his daze.
So, we're even, right? You killed his dog and we got back at you.
I didn't kill his dog,
Darren shouted, so loud that Peter, Jeremy, and I all instinctively looked back to make sure nobody was around to hear.
But you cut him up.
So what? I cut up a dead dog.
Darren ran his palm across the side of his neck and held it up to show us.
Look what you did to me. His dumb dog was already dead when I found it, so all I did was biology. You guys were almost murderers.
No, we weren't, I said. I told you we were just trying to scare you.
Darren shoved his palm into my face.
That's not what this looks like.
But it's true. We were going to let you down.
I don't care. I'm going back to school and I'm going to tell Mr. Seven exactly what you fuckers did to me.
He walked off. We helplessly watched him go.